This podcast was recorded on Bundjalung land of the Arakwal Nation. What is up, everybody? This is the Future Ancients podcast, and my name is Luca Lesson. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by my patrons, those legendary human beings who are still supporting me through this strange COVID era. They are donating a small amount of their earnings to me once a month so that I can continue to create in these strange times with 99% of my work being cancelled. I intend to continue this process of being connected with my patrons in a direct manner and just keep building this community that we are enjoying so much at the moment. I'm feeling incredibly supported. I've been able to make this podcast a reality. I've been able to make some spoken word poetry videos, one of which I released yesterday for Welcome to Paradox on my socials. Those of you who aren't on my socials, it is at Luca Lesson for both Instagram and for Facebook, / Luca Lesson. And because of your patronage, I'm able to continue to work on major projects as well, the longer term things like Agape and Other Kinds of Love, a project I've been working on for the past 2 years, and Odysseus, a retelling of the ancient Greek story of the Odyssey in hip-hop and spoken word with a orchestra and choir, a longer-term project that will take at least another year or two to see the light of day. So because of your patronage, I'm able to not have to drop the ball on all these things and just continue working and continue getting there, getting closer to my goals of releasing good art into the world for you good humans to experience. This episode of the podcast is with the great Michelle Grace Hunter. She is an incredible photographer, mostly a live music photographer, but is also incredible in a studio, doing studio photography. I myself have done a bunch of sessions with her. We've known each other for a number of years. We connected in Melbourne in the hip hop scene when we were both kind of hungry to make it in this world, to put our stamp on the scene, to do what we wanted to do. And we both have what I call the ethnic work ethic, her background being Italian and mine being Greek. We kind of connect on that level and embodying the work ethic of our migrant forefathers and parents and grandparents who came to Australia and made something out of nothing. We apply that to our art, and we've been good friends for a long time, and that is reflected in the fact that this conversation is the longest conversation that I've had so far. It's the longest episode of the podcast. We talked about everything from hip-hop to photography to Rule, the young artist that she follows around as the official photographer around the planet when touring was happening, and his trajectory. We talked about her Twitch channel that people are getting onto, that's going really well for her. We talked about the Black Lives Matter protests that she partook in Melbourne when they were happening. We had this conversation a little while back. It's taken me a minute to get to it, but I'm really stoked and excited to put this out into the world. And at the end of the conversation, I was wondering what kind of a poem I could put with this. What would be the influence? How would I take influence and inspiration from this conversation and put it out to the world? And I decided to record a poem that I'd already written before, that this connection that I have with Michelle really reminds me of, I guess. It really feels like it resonates. And that poem is called Amber Lights. And it's about basically my high school days, smoking with my friends in a vacant lot across the road from school in the mornings and at lunch hours, and kind of finding this place in the world of not being 100% comfortable, solely enclosed in the Greek community, not feeling 100% comfortable, I guess, solely enclosed in the mainstream white Australian community, and finding somehow solace and home in the in-betweens. And one of those in-betweens for both Michelle and I is the hip-hop scene, where all communities and all different colors, races, creeds, sexes, genders, and orientations can come together and feel safe. At least that's the hip-hop that I believe in and dream of. So that poem is called Amber Lights, and I hope you enjoy it. And in general, I hope you enjoy this episode, episode 5 of the Future Ancients podcast. Michelle Grace Honda, welcome to the Future Ancients podcast.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. It's weird seeing your face. I haven't seen your face for so long, so yeah. This is lovely.
You look completely different.
Yeah.
You've grown up.
I've grown up in the last however long it had been since I've seen you. How long is your hair at the moment? I can't tell because you've got a beanie on.
I've got the old beanie going. It's it's long, but I cut it actually in Greece.
Did you? You didn't do the shave thing again?
I didn't shave it, no, but I cut a good amount of length off it. And you know when you're at the hairdresser and, well, for those of us who are curly, you're at the hairdresser and your hair's wet and it looks super long and you're like, yeah, cut it there.
Yeah, cut it.
And then it dries and it, and it like you look like a mushroom.
It springs up, yes. But you've grown it out again now, you're all good.
Yeah, it's growing out again now. It's all good. What's going down? You got any good jokes? I need to be cheered up. It's been a crazy week in the world.
Yeah, it's been a bit heavy. Oh, it's been a crazy few months, really. No, don't have any jokes. I'm not really a good joke teller. I don't have much for you. But hopefully the chat will cheer up instead of the jokes.
I'm sure.
Yeah. It has been a very heavy time, that's for sure.
Yeah. As a live music photographer, you've had a bunch of shit cancelled, I'd imagine, as much as the rest of us.
Yeah, pretty much.
What's been going on with you?
Yeah, so I actually had stuff cancelled before everybody else because I had a tour that was going to Asia in March. So that was a tour that we had to go into China and then come back out. And because obviously the pandemic hit China first, that portion of the tour was like originally postponed, but it's been cancelled now. So I already had a big, like it was a whole month of work cancelled in like January. So I think I was slightly better mentally prepared because it wasn't just like it came out of the blue. It was like, okay, this has already happened. I was kind of scrambling to fill in the gaps, which I did. I was lucky to fill up that month with work. And then kind of just as that month finished, then we, you know, went into lockdown here. Yeah. So, basically I was meant to be touring from next month until April next year, pretty consistently on and off with the artists that I tour with. That's with Rule, yeah.
Yeah, Rule, sorry.
Rule, yeah. So all of that work has been just postponed at this stage. I'm pretty confident that'll come back whenever we're allowed to shoot concerts again. But so at the moment it's I've started just in the last 2 weeks shooting press shots and, you know, single and album covers for artists again. But it's been, that long since. I think I closed my studio on the 20th of March, maybe, or around then, 15th or 20th of March. And I just opened like 2 weeks ago. So, that's a big shock to the system because I'm a bit of a workaholic.
Yeah.
Like us wogs tend to be. So
yeah, we've talked about that, the ethnic work ethic. Can't stop. Yeah.
You can't stop.
That was my first reaction too as well. Like as soon as everything hit, I'm like, cool, what can I sink my teeth into? What can I?
Yeah.
I'm going to work
That's
hard
exactly
now.
That's exactly what I
some
did.
Some other shit I'm going to do.
Yeah.
It took me a while to settle down and relax and use it as an opportunity to like just rest and you know, it's really the first time since 2009 or 10 that I have been in one place for 3 months without catching a plane.
Wow. Yeah. It's very different for all of us. I think, I'm very much used to being on the go and doing a million things at once. So, I did have a lot of really anxious energy and didn't really know what to do with myself. And it was affecting me pretty badly for the first couple of weeks. And then I did throw everything into setting up a Twitch channel and started live streaming. So I've been doing that really consistently now for the last couple of months, and it has been a lifesaver.
Yeah, tell me about that. What is Twitch? I don't know anything about it. Tell me.
Yeah, cool. So the reason I found out about Twitch is actually it's a live streaming platform, but it's essentially been for the last, it's been around for ages, but it's always been really popular with gamers. So video game streaming. And my husband's actually making, he's in the background, you can see him.
Yeah. What up? Waving. Hey, bro.
It's Luca. Where he's making a documentary currently on esports and the professional video gaming. So he had showed me about a year ago what this platform was. And I was like, this is interesting, but I can't see how it would really apply to me. So I kind of forgot about it. And then when all this shit went down, I was like, oh, you know what? I'm just going to revisit it and see like if there's any possibility of doing something. And it took my, like took me a while to get my head around it, because it is very, very focused on gaming, and even just like reward systems and stuff are very gaming focused. But now that I have got my head around it, and the community that come to my streams have got my head around it, it's actually awesome. It's really, really cool. It's a subscriber model as well. So it's not, you don't have to subscribe, but people can choose to subscribe to support my channel. And it's just been just incredible. I've just started creating this really beautiful community of people who show up every single stream. We've got this thing, it's called a Discord channel. So it's another thing that's very, what used to be very gaming focused, but basically it's kind of like an online forum that people can talk to me anytime, but while I'm not streaming, and the whole community is there. So I've got sections on the Discord, like different channels, I guess, where we can talk about, just tips and tricks for photography, or potentially people feedback on work, or I do a weekly challenge every week. So we're talking about like, what's the challenge? What are tips to doing this? Just a real community vibe, basically. And it's been life-changing, like that's honestly mad. Life-changing. Yeah.
And so when you do a live stream, what are you doing? Are you just talking to people? You're doing a shoot? Are you?
Totally depends. I have a few different types of streams. So Sundays are my creative challenge Sundays. So basically I set a challenge on Sunday for everybody. And then the following Sunday, we look at everybody's submissions. So the whole stream, I'm talking to people about the photos that they've submitted and giving them feedback and giving them props. And so that's a really great way of engaging with the community. The other two, I do Tuesday nights and Thursday nights. Usually they're interviews with industry professionals, so other music photographers or people that I come into contact with a lot. So it could be like publicists or stylists, makeup artists, people that's relevant to what we do. And sometimes I just go live randomly just when I'm editing, or I'll do like a workshop. So today is a Photoshop workshop, or today is a Lightroom workshop. So they're like less structured and more people can just ask me questions whenever, and I'll just go through stuff with them. So yeah, it really varies. So it's taken me a long while to get my head around what works on Twitch, and Twitch is very long form. So people, the longer you can stream, the better. And people will just pop in. Like if you're streaming, they say that a minimum stream should go for 3 hours.
Wow.
So I've really been, usually mine go for about two, but I've been struggling to try. I always like, surely people get bored after a while, but the people at Twitch are like, no, this is what our platform is built for. Like it's literally about people finding you, coming to hang out, you know, hopefully liking your personality and chilling and asking questions and stuff. So it's taken me ages to get my head around it, but
crazy,
it's starting to work. Like it's really fun. It's really good.
That's mad. And so how many people are in your community now, like aroundabouts?
I think I've got like 550 followers, and I've got the subscriber thing is per month. So yeah. I think I was like 72 subscribers, like as of yesterday. It goes up and down all the time.
Yeah,
and in the Discord is around about that as well. It's probably 70 or 80 people in the Discord group. Those people are really my regulars. They're the ones that show up all the time.
That's your crew.
Yeah, it's my crew. Yeah, they come all the time. We're always chatting about stuff. Feels like a big family. So yeah, it's great. It's only been like, you know, not even 3 months yet. So,
but you're on there like almost every day, sounds like.
Like every second day or so.
Yeah.
The thing that I'm learning now is about engaging with other people in the community. And that's really, really helped just other people that are streaming, I'll pop into their streams, just say, hey, what up, hang out for a bit, get to know them. And then they'll come to my stream and be like, oh my God, what you do is so cool. And then sometimes they bring people. So last night my channel got what's called a raid. So someone brought their entire, all the people that were watching, which was like 33 people, they just dumped them in my channel and said, we think what Michelle's doing is really cool. You should come and hang out. So there's some really cool features like that, which, like, again, was centered around gaming, but is transferable to other streamers. So now there's musicians. I'm seeing heaps of musicians and artists jumping on and live streaming and building their communities. And the Twitch guys have explained to me, for musicians, it's kind of, it works really well because you can say to people, like, you know, if you like what I'm doing, just kind of leave me like a tip, you know, like a couple of dollars or something, like you would if you were busking, you know. It can work really well like that as well. So yeah, it's definitely something completely new and awesome. And yeah, I feel it's definitely saved my mental health during this period of like, it could have been utter despair. So
yeah, that's awesome. I really like that. I like that because when everything went down, actually before everything went down, I'd been planning to do a Patreon page for a while.
Yep.
And so because all this shit went down, I was like, well, now's the time. So I kind of just went for it. And it's gone really well. Like, I'm very humbled by everybody's support and everybody's desire to come on board and help me create and, you know, be supportive. But it is lacking slightly the fact that most people that are on there, they don't download the app for Patreon. And the app for Patreon, there's like a private stream in there, like a basically it's like a Facebook, but only for your patrons.
Patrons.
So you can post videos, you can live stream into there, you can post whatever updates and, you know, whatever you want, photos, talk about what you've been up to, chat with people, message people. But most people don't download the Patreon app. So they just do their thing. They just,
they're just supporting you monthly.
They support on a monthly basis, and that's mad. But they don't necessarily stay in contact on there. They still are in contact with me on my socials.
Yep.
So anyone listening to this who is my patron, download the Patreon app.
Download that. Yeah.
Because I think eventually, just say I get like 1,000 people on there, then it's almost like you don't really need your socials anymore. Like, you've got this tight-knit community. Yeah.
Yep.
You can create stuff and still put that stuff that you create up on socials and up on platforms like YouTube and whatever. But like, your core crew is just through this channel, you know?
Totally. Yeah.
And that's, and it's direct, and there's no algorithms stopping them from seeing certain things that you post, or.
Yeah. You get control back over the following that you're building, which is what we've totally lost through other social media.
Exactly.
Platforms, you know?
Yeah. It's like one step away from just having everybody on WhatsApp.
Yeah. You know, which I kind of really like that as well. Like, I've really, for me, it's like the last couple of years have taken on a real kind of mentoring focus, and I'm really focused on trying to get young women to pick up cameras and become music photographers, because we're so, you know, it's such a large disparity, gender disparity still. So it's just like, any spare time I can just be encouraging these, you know, and it's not just all girls, but it's majority girls, to, you know, all of the different things that, you know, take 5, 6, 7 years to learn because nobody tells you. Like, I can just tell them straight up and be like, these are all the unwritten rules that no one will tell you until you fuck up and, you know, someone tells you off and, you know, you're black banned from something, which, you know, has happened. So,
that's they're the gems that people pay a lot of money for. You know what I mean? That's the stuff that really is so powerful as people that have experience for us to share with younger poets or younger photographers or people wanting to get into our industries, to just be open with that, with those conversations. Totally. It's almost like my favorite part of what I do, in a way, is because it's so liberating to just be like,
oh, dude, agree.
Don't do that shit. Trust me, do this and this and this. It'll
liberating is such a good word, I feel, because I just didn't have that, like, at all. Like, I had nobody to ask those hard questions, and it just took me fumbling, like, especially stuff around making the transition from when, you know, you're shooting at the start and you might be shooting for free for a long time, and that transition to, you know, charging and what to charge and all of those things. It's like, it's such a big barrier as artists to get over anyway, like how much do I charge for my art? But especially at the start. So just being really open with that and just go, hey, this is industry standards. This is what, where you should be about. If you're at the start, maybe here, if you're a mid tier here, and then a little bit more advanced, and like, and also I think it helps with just, because we, you know, we have a chronic issue with people just underquoting and undercutting and trying to get, you know, a standard where everyone is approximately, is actually really beneficial for the whole industry. So, yeah.
It is, because, I mean, it's an interesting question, actually, because I did a lot of free gigs when I was starting out.
So did I.
Like the first, I still do free gigs for things that I believe in.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
I think that's cool, but I did a lot of free gigs in the beginning for like the first 2 years. I did like, you know, 100 gigs a year anywhere in any way I could, and majority of them were unpaid.
Yep, I would be very similar numbers, I reckon.
yeah, because I met this dude named Emmanuel Jal, who's a Sudanese rapper who escaped South Sudan and got to the UK and became a poet and rapper and wrote a book, and I was like, what do I do? How do I make it in this poetry hip hop world? You know? And I thought he was going to give me some mad Instagram quote, inspirational piece of advice. But his advice was do 100 gigs a year.
Yep.
That's it. And you'll have content, you'll have new poems, you'll have an audience.
It seems to be like a really great number, because I've said similar things to people about like the amount of gigs that you have to shoot at the start. And I think it also, it can scare people off, but it's also like the reality of what like you need to do, if that makes sense. Like that, to get any type of point of difference with people that are just going to drop off mainly. So, just going really hard. There's no like shortcuts basically. So
yeah,
just go hard.
The only shortcut is if you do 200 gigs a year.
Totally. Yeah. Which I think I did. I think I might've been closer to 200 at the start.
Yeah. There was one year when I got to, when I first went to Chile with Isa, and I got there and I counted everything before when I got there, like at the end of the year, I like to do a little bit of a count up.
You know? Yeah.
And it was 220 that year. And I was so tired, man. I slept for 2 weeks when we arrived. I just slept for 2 weeks.
I remember there was one year, I think it was the year that I put out Rise, which would make sense because when I was doing the book, and I was sometimes doing like 5 or 6 shoots a day when I was traveling. But I think I did more shoots than days that year, which was 2014.
That's nice.
So, but it also was the year that set my entire career up, you know, like after the book came out. Then it was kind of like I could actually relax a little bit because people knew who I was and all that sort of stuff. But stupid amounts. Like we're just crazy. Like
And I'm not sure if that's good. If that's good advice.
Yeah, maybe don't go that hard.
Maybe that's probably not good advice. But
go for 100. 100's a good number. Yeah, I think
you learn your limits.
Yeah,
you learn your pushing your edges, and you also learn your capacity. Like holy fuck, if someone does book me this much, I can do that. Like. I have flown to Hong Kong overnight and arrived at 7 a.m., got it off the plane, gone straight to a classroom, taught 4, 5, 6 lessons of, you know, poetry, gone, checked into the hotel after school, slept, you know, done that for 5 days straight, flown to the next city, done another, you know, like you can do it. It's not good for you, but you can
it's not overly healthy.
Pretty amazing things. When I was in Greece once and, we went to Greece. I went to Greece early to learn from academics there about the Odyssey a bit more deeply, to learn about the project I'd been working on, still am working on. And then I was going to my grandfather's village to do the poetry retreat. And Splendor in the Grass booked me for the weekend in between. And I flew back for the weekend and did 3 shows at Splendor in the Grass and flew back to Greece.
To Greece. That's so far.
And it was ridiculous.
It's not just like a little 2-hour flight, you know.
No, And you know what? What happened was I stopped being negative about it. I stopped being like, oh, this is so difficult. This is so hard. This is so shit. I just stayed positive. And I just like drank heaps of water on the flight, and I stood up and stretched heaps on the flights.
Yeah.
And I did the gigs, and it was mad fun.
Yeah.
And flew back and slept for 12 hours straight. You know, when I got back, I hit.
When you got back, yeah.
Hit the bed at 8 p.m. and woke up at 8 a.m. and that's it.
And you're good to go.
It's not ideal, but
if you need to do it every now and again,
humans
you can
are
do
pretty
it.
Yeah, every now and then we're pretty, you know, pretty amazing how durable we can be, you know, if we test it. But yeah, going too hard can affect the quality of the work, and that's a problem when that
absolutely
happens.
Yeah you definitely don't want to get to that point where, you know, like you've hit that point of utter exhaustion, which I've hit quite a few times. But I had a really great mentor friend of mine who I remember telling him at one point, it was quite early on, but I was just like, it's just utter exhaustion. And he was like, cool. So when you feel like this, he said, it's time to put up your rates.
Yeah.
And every time I've hit that point, I've done that, and it is a absolute lifesaver.
Yeah.
It actually works, and then you find that balance again.
Yeah.
And off you go again, and we hit that point again. So great piece of advice.
That is a really good piece of advice, because you can't, you know, as artists, and there's been so much talk these days about the value of artists in society, and I saw something today that was like a public vote about, you know, the number one.
Oh yes, useless. How we were the non-essential, the most non-essential workers.
Basically the least essential.
The least. I tweeted about yesterday. I said, "Shout out to my non-essential existence."
Yeah. Dude, artists are like, the least.
I know.
The least essential.
I was like, wow, like, are these people watching television or listening to music or going to the theater or like all of the things that makes art, like going to any type of performance, like.
So funny.
So the things that we do are the things that people do for entertainment, I guess, in their relaxation.
Well, yes and no. Like your watch was
that's
designed
true.
By
design.
An artist.
Yeah, that's
but
true.
Even the graph that they had in the newspaper that was showing, that was designed by an artist in order to communicate that idea.
It's so funny. It's like, you're right. Especially when you get into design stuff, it's like everything has been designed by an artist. But I mean, like it's it's interesting when it's shown to you that that's what people think about. I mean, it's definitely evident in Australia in terms of what the government thinks about art and where the funding goes, and, you know, continually getting funding cuts, and you know, the art sector hasn't been overly well supported during this time and all that stuff. Like, sucks.
Yeah. What do you think's going to happen in September? You think that they're going to...
That's a good question. I don't know.
An artist-specific thing, or you think they're going to just run out of JobKeeper and say...
It'll be interesting. I don't think they can say bad luck. I think there's way too many people. And if they say bad luck, they'll be really underestimating that. And that number of unemployment's not going to be 7.1%. It's probably going to be about 15%, and that will scare the shit out of them. So, yeah, I think it's... time's going to tell, I guess. I mean, my husband and I both were able to get JobKeeper, which has been, so fortunate. I don't know what we would have done if we weren't able to get that. Would have been really, really very scary, very horrifically scary. So we were both fortunate that we qualified for that as sole traders. There's so many of my friends that, you know, were contractors, for example, and do, you know, they go from 3 or 4 month contractors. They didn't have an employee for more than 12 months, so they didn't apply. So it's fucking awful.
Yeah. For me, it's crazy because usually I work really hard and really intensely for the middle part of the year while education centers and schools and colleges and universities are open.
Yep.
And then from October basically to March, I don't have any work really. And that's when I usually try and cut my losses and get out of Australia and go somewhere where it's cheaper to live. And write and create the art in that period. But this year, that's not happening. You know, I won't, you know, if it cuts off in September and then I still can't visit schools or, you know, whatever's happening with that, because there's still talk about, you know, what's possible and what's not possible by then in terms of entering schools and large groups of students in one place at a time and all that kind of stuff. Then, yeah, it's going to be a struggle over that part of the year. And I don't think the government understands. I mean, they do understand in terms of the ATO, like artists, especially artists that are painters, if they have one exhibition once every 3 years, then they don't get taxed on having made all of that money from that one exhibition in that 1 year. That year, that income gets spread over the 3 years that they worked on that. So then their tax bracket goes down. So the government does understand something of that,
that
kind of way of life that's similar to mine, but they're not necessarily catering for that at the moment when it comes to the processes with JobKeeper in terms of shutting it down, you know.
Yeah, I think anyone that's that relies on, like, the, you know, the gig economy or going from show to show or film to film, or I used to work in the film industry, so I was really aware of going from contract to contract. You'd go 3 months and 4 months and 6 months, and you'd have 3 months off in between, and, you know, so all of my friends from the film days, they all missed out, all of them. It's just and you know, everyone was writing petitions, and it's just, and then when you hear that they've, like, completely fucked up the budget and they have this, you know, extra $60 billion sitting around, but then they still won't help those people. It's just like, that's just actually cruel. Like, that's, or just not understanding, like saying things like, well, you know, these casuals, they would have a surplus because they get paid more. And it's like, you don't understand how people work. Like, people aren't just putting, like, large sums of money away. Like, it's just not how people live in Australia. Like, everyone's so living from paycheck to paycheck. It's so really out of touch.
It's crazy how out of touch it is.
It is.
And I worry that, you know, without being too cynical, although I am pretty cynical about our governments, I worry that a lot of it is basically kind of going, well, the artists are the ones that make the most noise about governments making bad decisions.
And
in those industries, you know, they do have in a sense, we do own a section of the media in terms of the media that we make and that we put out into the world. And it's independent and it's small and it's not as loud as TV channels, but, you know, socials and things like that, it's strong.
That,
like,
would be, if they continue thinking that way, they don't have very long with that being, because I mean, I've seen the power of what happens with independent streaming platforms and what's possible now, and that is not going to be like that for very much longer. Like, the power is going to be completely taken away, and it's not very far away. So sucks to be them soon.
Well, that's what my friend said to me today. He's like, well, that never works, you know, like, even with the cuts that they've made to universities where they're making certain degrees cheaper and other degrees more expensive, and those degrees that are more expensive are kind of advocacy degrees, you know, degrees that where people learn to question the world and learn to you know, provoke change. And to think that all of this, if I'm being cynical, all of this is about kind of keeping artists down, you know, while we're still down, not giving us a leg up to then start making noise again, to make our degrees more expensive, or the degrees of advocates or lawyers or people that can advocate for human rights more difficult, to not acknowledge how much money the artists raised during the bushfire crisis, and not under and fully underestimate how much work we did with that, or you guys did with that, because I was overseas and feeling frustrated from a distance. And I really think that it has the adverse reaction, you know, like when you try and clamp down artists, it has the complete opposite effect.
I agree.
No matter where no matter where you are in the world. But I don't think they have the foresight to see how that has worked in other countries yet, because Australia hasn't really had that to a heavy degree yet. They haven't seen us really go hard.
Well, it could be the time. So
it's interesting, eh? It's crazy.
It is really interesting. Yeah. Sorry, there's so many times where I've just been like, I look at Jarvis and go, a fucking pandemic. Like honestly, who would have thought?
Yeah.
It's just wild.
Are you with it though? Where are you with it? With how real versus not real?
I'm very on the real. I'm on the real.
You're on the real train. Team?
Yeah, I'm on the real team. I had seen a film, like a documentary, like probably 2 months before all of this went down, that basically was saying there's probably, they didn't know when, but there will be something that's very much like this. And I was telling my friends about it, and I'm like, this will happen, and then it will, you know, spread from animals to humans. And it kind of played out exactly like they were saying it would at one point. And I guess I got obsessed with listening to like epidemiologists and biochemists and people in this particular field. So I started listening to like a lot of podcasts on the topic, and I'm pretty certain that, yeah, it's a real thing. And
in what sense real though? What does that mean? What does that mean for you?
I think it's a, you know, it's a virus that affects people obviously quite differently. Seems to obviously the mortality rate has been actually quite different depending on where you live, but disproportionately affecting elderly, and it seems in America, African Americans, which they're not really sure why, but there's been a few theories about vitamin D levels and all kinds of stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, like it's, but the thing is, in terms of how bad people thought it potentially could have been, I don't think it's as bad. And I also think that we in Australia have been quite fortunate in that we did kind of lock down early enough and seem to relatively have it under, well, as of today, it's gone up, spiked again in Victoria, but got it to a relatively, you know, a spot that we can kind of maintain. And yeah, I'm definitely not on the conspiracy theory wagon, and I'm definitely not, I'm also not on the, you know, it's about government control and any of that. Like, you know, I because I was aware of it really early because of what happened with the cancelling in China, I was very across it in China, very across it in Italy, in Spain, what it was doing over there. So, yeah, it's, you know, definitely serious, definitely needs to be under control to a point that we, you know, the hospitals aren't going to be overwhelmed. But hopefully we can get to a point where we can at least live our lives soon again, you know, to some type of normality, which we seem to be almost getting there again. So,
yeah. Yeah. Normality. What's that?
Yeah, well, that's exactly
that
right.
What we that, want? What is that? I don't know.
Yeah.
I definitely felt a simultaneous deep, depression kind of coming over me, like, oh, these cancellations, and simultaneously this great relief.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That kind of said normality to me, well, then if I had the choice, I would have. I think that's what universal basic income gives us. Mm-hmm. It gives us the choice to do things the way we want to do them.
And I'm a more big often fan, than not, big that fan makes, of that.
Yeah, more often than not, that makes for better outcomes, better art, better creativity, better relationships,
totally.
Better
yeah,
mental health.
I've listened to quite a few podcasts on the that as a theory, and if you know, it seems to be that could be something that works really well for sure. Yeah. And you know, times like this kind of show that as well, really.
Yeah, and it's seen as such a like a socialist thing, universal basic income. And I saw someone post the other day saying, if capitalism works so well, how come socialism has to bail it out every 10 years? Or something?
Every 10 years. Yeah, I saw that as well. Yeah, it's so true. It was really funny to see, you know, the liberal government go quite socialist when this all happened. It's like, you know, what the hell are you guys doing? So it does work, but, you know, you guys are just dead against it.
Yeah.
It's like,
and you had the money to do it.
But you didn't, because you guys are assholes.
And actually, some studies have shown that what happens with universal basic income is that women are more likely to start their own businesses.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because they're freed up with their time for certain things. They're able afford childcare and, you know, pursue their own creative pursuits and these types of things. So that's an awesome thing.
That's really interesting, yeah. That's cool. Yeah, but when you say like normality, like for me, that was more about, I guess, returning to the things that I love. And because I like, in terms of my life and what I've been able to create, I have been able to create something that I genuinely do love. And so normal for me wasn't really, although I, you know, have a tendency to take on too much work, I genuinely love what I do. I genuinely love touring and shooting with all of these amazing artists and stuff. And so I wanted it to go back to that because I love what I do. Not the normal that everyone else is talking about where it's a 9-to-5, the grind. Like my life is not like that. So, you know, I've had
work way more than 9-to-5. But
exactly. Yeah. So it's more the concerts and touring stuff that I would really love to be shooting again soon.
Yeah. I don't think my normal is going to look like it was before, but I'm excited for what it's going to be. I'm beginning to build a online resource for education centers of all my workshops, all my tips and tricks and everything I've ever basically.
I'm in the process of doing that as well. Like quite literally in the process of like in the middle of doing that for music photographers as well. Like there's nothing like that that exists in Australia. So
mad. How are you going to work it? Are you going to make it a like an online course or?
Yeah. An online course. I had like someone approach me actually after she'd seen my first Twitch stream, and she had done an online course to somebody else, and she's like, I think you could totally like do this. There's like nobody's doing it in this space. So she's actually, there's a girl that's actually helping me kind of put it all together in some type of formula. And so I'm kind of brain dumping at the moment and just furiously typing everything that I've learned in the last 10 years to have some type of resource that's like from when you start, you know, picking up a camera to how do you get a media pass? Who do you need to speak to? What do you wear? Like, who do you talk to when you get there? And what do you charge? All of those things that like, just, yeah, you don't know because
how not to swear at kids when you're taking child portraits in the studio.
Yeah, totally. I'm really bad at that because I'm a bad swearer. So don't swear at kids.
That was meant to be a hypothetical example, but it's
really no, it's very real with me. So
nice. That sounds mad. That sounds awesome.
Also, same with you. That'd be great. That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm looking forward. I mean, I imagine you know how it feels now just to get all that information out of your head, like to just take it off your shoulders.
I did it basically all over maybe 2 days where I just, and I was so exhausted after it.
Yeah.
It took so much out of me. And like this girl that I've been working with kind of put, she kind of put dot points, like, you know, and I would just, you know, see the dot point and then just write, this is what I know about this. This is what I know about this. And just like, ugh. Yeah. And I guess it's that thing that you said about even like having a value to that information. Cause I've never thought about that really. Like a lot of this information I do just give out freely if people ask, but having a resource that is there that, you know, it's like a whole course that people can choose to pay for and make it affordable, like it doesn't have to be a lot of money, but that's kind of cool as well, I think.
Yeah, I think it's cool to make it affordable, but also give free places to people that you want to mentor.
Yeah, that's actually, totally. I mean, I do that anyway. Yeah. Like I'm always give away, like depending on which, I do about 5 or 6 mentoring spaces a year anyway. And I've aligned with a couple of different Indigenous groups as well. So I'm always trying to mentor young Indigenous women coming through. That's one of my passions. Even giving away photo shoots if they're artists to help them have really professional photos and stuff like that. But I totally agree having some type of way that people can, if they're, you know, come from backgrounds that potentially they can't, you know, disadvantaged backgrounds or whatever, it's a resource that they can still have access to. So yeah, that would 100% be a thing.
Yeah, that's mad. And it's amazing how many people have made online courses based on about 3 good pieces of information.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You know what I mean? Like they have just like a tiny bit of,
They give you a little bit of gold in there.
They've got this tiny bit of gold that they could have just told us in 20 minutes, you know?
Yeah.
But it like builds like this huge thing around it. Yeah. Whereas I know you, those of us who work so hard just to break into a scene and to create something out of a scene and to turn it into a career and, you know, go full time with it when we probably shouldn't even think about going full time with it yet. Like you learn so much on the way and you don't even think about the value of what you've learned. You're just like, I'm trying to get over there. Like I'm trying to get,
That's such a good point. Like I went professional within 6 months. Like that is
of picking up a camera
like that is like who does that? I had no idea what I was doing. It's crazy when I think about it, but I just like, you know, when I absolutely just threw myself into it and it just became my life. Like there wasn't any other option at that point. Like, you know, something had happened in a previous career. I didn't have any other options at that point. It's like I had to work. So it was just like
So, I lied.
Did you?
I fully lied. My first ever like hip-hop workshop gig that I did at a school in Brisbane, they asked me if I'd had experience and I'd be like I've done heaps.
Totally fake it till you make it.
Just because I knew I could do it. Like I knew I'd be good at it. I knew that, you know, it'd be
back
great.
Yourself.
It'd be fun. And it was mad. Totally. And I fully backed myself and it was sick. I still remember it very clearly, the whole process and what we built and what we made out of it and how surprised everyone was. And the young people were rapping in front of the whole school. And these are kids that are meant to be shy and kind of meant to be unable to do that stuff because they were child soldiers. They were from Burundi, so they had really hardcore backgrounds, really intense backgrounds. But I didn't want to read their background folder, you know, like I didn't want to pigeonhole them that's what you are. And so I actually didn't read what the teachers had showed me. Like the teachers were like, oh, here, you should go through their files and, you know, learn, you know, this and that. And I didn't want to sit there and go, oh my God, look at all these things they've gone through. I don't know how to act around them.
Yeah.
They're refugees, you know, like they're just kids, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Crew, you know, like they're just young legends that want to express themselves and make some tunes. And we'd go and just jam on guitar or jam on whatever. And we made some songs and rehearsed them and memorized them and performed them in front of the whole school. And everyone
That's
was
so cool.
freaking out. And I was just like, I knew I could do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like I
love that. That's so cool.
And sometimes, sometimes that's right. Like diving in is the only thing that's going to make you swim. You know?
Absolutely.
It's not for everyone because some other people advise that you should just get a part-time job 2 days a week and do your love thing 3 days a week and then you never have to go through that hardcore stress of like where the bills come from.
There's something about the stress that I think I definitely work really well under pressure and just so I think you definitely have to be that type of person and it's not for everyone, so definitely not recommending people just throw everything in.
Have you ever turned up like super unprepared for like a really important shoot, someone's coming and you
not really I mean sometimes
been called maybe last minute to do something
That's definitely happened but more like I've had a few situations where you think that you're prepared and then you get there and like, you know, your battery's dead or something or you've forgotten. I there's been a few phone calls to Jarvis and like, hey, can you chuck this in an Uber right now to here because I've left this really important thing that I need. I had recently actually the first shoot that I did back after isolation. I was actually shooting for someone that I hadn't met before, but they got me to shoot something for them because I think they're in Sydney or something. So I was shooting something for them and I went really early, got all my lighting set up. I was fully prepared. The clients arrived and I've gone to shoot and my camera was just dead. Like it just didn't work. It's like 3 months in isolation. And I was like, holy shit. I have a backup camera which I didn't bring that day. So I was like, what do I do? And so I just ran into the studio manager. He shoots with a Canon and I shoot Nikon anyway. I was like, dude, I need your camera. Can you please borrow it? And he's like, yeah, sure. So, you know, you always think of way, like creative ways. There hasn't been anything like super disastrous. I'm pretty resourceful, like, and also pretty good at
Except for when snakes get stuck in typewriters. Oh
my God, I completely forgotten about that. I just went instant anxiety thinking about the snake, the poor snake that got stuck.
Nobody knows that story, so this is now everyone's going to find out.
My brain is exploding.
The famous antidote clip that people like. I talk about that clip everywhere around the world.
It's an awesome clip.
Yeah, Claudia smashed it, and you were there taking shots, live shots, and you know.
Yeah, we did some. I think the poster and stuff was.
We did the poster shot, and we took some beautiful. Still, I see some of those photos. I'm just like, man, I'm so glad we figured out all of that and did that shoot.
We're
doing the video, and this one of the snakes crawls into the typewriter, and it's kind of thin enough to get in, but not thin enough to get all the way through to the other side.
Snakes don't really go backwards because of their scales.
So we have to pull apart, because I had to pull apart my friend's vintage typewriter.
It cost me like
$300 to put it back together. Because there's like one person.
1700s or some shit. It was like
It was really old.
Rare typewriter.
Very old.
Yeah. And, it was beautiful, but
super beautiful.
And the poor snake. You know how the snake just stopped moving. Like it fully was like.
It's just like I'm
under so much trauma. I was like, it was stressing me out. I was like, I can't.
I don't think it would. Yeah, it looked like it, but I think the guy that was handling the snake was, you know, he was just like, yeah, we'll figure it out. You know, it's all good, whatever.
Yeah, but like I've had a few shoots with snake handlers after that, and I don't know how much they care about their snakes.
Oh yeah, we cared more about the snake than he did.
I think we cared more. Yes, yeah. I've had another situation with some snakes on set, and I was just like,
yeah. What the hell? Just in case anyone who's listening who's worried about the traumatization of the snake, it was a professional snake.
The snake was fine.
It was a professional performance snake. It was a professional performance snake with a professional handler.
But he was actually fine. Like the typewriter was. Screwed, but the snake was fine.
That's what we decided in the end. We decided we'll kill the typewriter.
Yeah.
Rather than hurt a snake.
Exactly. I think the right choice. So.
I think the problem was just that it made the guy late because he was like on his way to a birthday party or something.
Oh, I know. So yeah, when you do, my mind had gone back to the first time that we shot before when you were talking about something where we went to that factory, like that abandoned. Yeah,
that was crazy.
Yeah. Such I love space. Those shoots. Just like randomly rocking up and can we break in? Yes, we can. Let's go see. Like it was really cool.
Melbourne's full of that though. I think that's the goodness of being in a city like that is that there's always a new kind of warehouse.
Yes.
Becoming, or an old warehouse becoming available or.
Yeah. That place was so cool. I shot there a couple of times actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I shot the Killing Time video there too.
I think you'd been there before. That's why you knew of it.
Yeah. And that's the thing about Melbourne too. Even that Please Resist Me video that I did there, that's all of those walls, all of the different people in those video, in that video, they're all like within 500 meters of each other. Like they're all around East Brunswick in between Lygon and
Oh, you know, they're always pulling stuff down to make new apartments. So like,
yeah, there's always a cool wall. So, you know, like it was all just the hood near where I was living at the time. And it's like,
Melbourne is the best like that. It is like,
oh man, so much character in every corner.
Yeah, totally. We're very lucky, that's for sure.
Yeah, except for Q.
Oh, who would go over there?
It's like the most expensive area and there's no character at all.
We just went there recently. We bought a new car like not that long ago, just kind of pre-corona, we had to go to Kew to pick it up. So it's the last time I went to Kew. It is such a weird suburb.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the suburb that you go to for hard rubbish days to get get shit that people throw out.
Just throw out. Wrong with it. No, because they're so rich, they just put it out on the side of it. We don't need this anymore.
Perfectly good sound system. Yeah, I just bought a better one. Might put it out on the street.
Totally. That's funny.
Crazy. Hey, how's the documentary going? Her sound, her story. What's happening with it now?
It's online, so people can watch the film online, and it's gone into schools now as of, kind of March, really. We launched it, which was a really great time.
How has it gone into schools?
There's an online resource that was created that people could, if you are part of a school, I guess, you can just pay a licensing fee, and then there's a whole curriculum written around the film. So there was somebody that we got to do that had created the whole thing. And it's like a PDF file, you know, that has all of the different resources. I'm not super across this because I was on tour when a lot of that was happening, and Claudia and this other lady put it together. But it's available now for
awesome.
Which is cool.
So if any teachers who are listening and they want, which curriculum would it be connected to?
A few different ones, actually,
different
from memory.
Faculties?
Yeah, like it's not one. I think like it's connected to English and music, obviously, the music. But there's, media studies. Yeah. There's like quite a few high school related things that it is connected to, and you're able to, you know, download if you want. It's, obviously great. Film for that age group to see regardless. And then the fact that there's a curriculum attached to it's really cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was always the goal. So it's nice that that's happened. Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome. That's a great goal. I think a lot of the art that we're making should make its way into schools and education centers.
I mean, that's where, for something like this, when you're talking about gender disparity and industry change and stuff, like it starts at schools, really. Like it starts with that, understanding the issue, understanding what is happening, why people are dropping off. Because if you're aware of it already, then if an issue comes up for you, you can be like, oh, cool, we learned about this. This is a thing that happens to young women. Yes, we suffer from confidence issues when we're in our early 20s or whatever. Just being aware of it, I think, rather than going, oh my God, I'm so alone. I feel really, I'm the only person going through this. This is too overwhelming. I'm just going to drop out, sort of thing. So I think there's something in the collective knowledge of just knowing that, it is, a lot of us do go through those things, and talking about it with other people and that sort of thing can really help the issue too.
That's amazing. And is it on certain platforms or is it just available through the website?
It's through the website. If you just go to hersoundherstory.com, you can both watch the film, which the film is actually on Vimeo on demand, but the resources developed, you can just download it from the actual website. So, yeah.
Yeah. And the beauty with projects like that is that it's kind of one of those moments that brings people together from different, you know, corners of musical genres and parts of Australia and parts of the world. And it really kind of, I don't know, from looking from afar and knowing you so well and knowing Claudia so well, I've just seen this kind of merging of all these different identities and all these women getting together and going, oh shit, I've been through that too. I went through that
too.
Oh yeah, that person fucked me over as well. Oh, have you done this? Have you tried that? Like, and it just feels like it was a real turning point for women.
Yeah, it does. It
just
does feel
forgetting
like
everyone
that
in the room.
Absolutely. And just talking about, like, you know, you've got women from, you know, pretty much every generation from the 60s right through to now, collectively sharing their experiences. And there's a real strength in that, because it wasn't about, oh, you know, we're victims and we suffer from this discrimination. It was actually, no, this is just our story. So this is what we experience. And there is a real power in learning that those experiences are really common and, you know, coming together and sharing that, and for the women to come together. There were some women that had, you know, because of how the industry is set up, might have been in competition with each other for so long, but then have come together and gone, this is stupid. This is like, the system was built for us to be in competition with each other. We didn't need to be in competition with each other. There's so much room for there to be so many more women, not just one, you know, queen of pop or one, you know, it's that's how it's been sold to everybody. So you fall into the trap of believing that, but it's just bullshit. So yeah,
amazing. And is there another one on the cards?
I don't think so. No, no.
That was big
I think
enough.
Like,
that was a monster.
I think it needs time, if you know, like, you know, I think that, you know, potentially in 10 years, if the conversations, hopefully the conversation is not being happened, so we don't need to have, yeah, you know, don't need to have another one.
Yeah.
But I feel like in terms of what I set out to do with having the concept of the, you know, it was both a portrait series and a film about women in music. I feel very much like that was done, and that piece of my career is, I feel quite, what's the word? You know, it's completely rounded off for me now, if that makes sense.
You've got closure.
I've got closure. Yeah. So yeah, I feel very much like I've kind of moved past that phase, and it's such a beautiful part of my career, and has really, you know, established me of being a big part of the Australian music industry and all of that, and I'm so thankful for it. But feel like I've moved on past that now and have other projects and stuff that I'm working on. So,
and what's that? Can you share any of those exciting?
There was a big project that things I started on just before COVID hit, and I've kind of put that back on the back burner. But I really feel like now, developing this Twitch community and making this as big as that I can possibly make it is like completely taken over my life. And really, and for me, it's just really giving back constantly. So I'm constantly thinking about how to make the stream better, both better quality, awesome guests, like, so that everybody that turns up feels like they're learning something every single time they tune in. So that's a, you know, that's a constant challenge if I'm streaming 3 times a week. So yeah, that's really where my head's at the moment. And yeah, see how long, I mean, I want to kind of continue this indefinitely. It's going to be interesting once I start touring again. I don't think I'll be able to stream quite as frequently, but definitely try, as you know, for as long as I'm here, which I assume will be at least for the rest of this year.
Wow.
Keep,
I
really
guess, because we can't travel internationally until,
yeah, so most of Rule's touring is, I mean, he does tour here as well, but the biggest stuff that we were doing was all overseas. So
yeah,
you know, just yeah, continue and connect with the community as much as I can, and just show up because they keep showing up. So yeah, yeah.
Awesome.
It's cool. Yeah.
And but you're still shooting portraits and other things,
yeah,
in your studio.
Yeah, exactly.
Same studio?
North Melbourne, where the snake episode happened. yes, still do. I'd completely forgot about that. So
the episode.
Yeah, I just started taking bookings a couple of weeks ago, and it's like already just, you know, crazy. So shooting a couple of times a week and doing some really, I'm actually been stoked with my work since I've got back. It's like, I think there was a lot of creative energy that needed to be expelled. Yeah. So all the shoots have been really great so far. And yeah, I just can't wait to shoot concerts again. I miss it so much. Like, it's, that's the reason that I live, essentially. So.
And you've been working with Rural from the beginning, pretty much, right? So you've seen
development. That's why it's like such a special project for me. Like, I really feel like it's been the most fulfilling thing that I've ever worked on in my career, because we started working with him when he was so young. So, you know, the first shoot I did with him, I think he might have just turned 14, and he's just about to turn 18 soon. So, you know, he's 17 at the moment. So, yeah, it's been, I've been there since the first ever time he performed with M Phases was at Section 8. You know, with a crowd of 100 people or whatever. Mm. So I've documented pretty much every show that he's done since.
You were there at that gig?
Yeah, I was there at that gig. I was looking at photos the other day, actually. And
now what's the capacity of his gigs in Australia or overseas?
The biggest one he's done, I guess, of his like headline would have been the last tour, which was he did both Festival Hall and Horden Pavilion, which I think is 5,000. So that's pretty, it's about as big as you get in Australia before you do arenas. And I think they're talking about he hasn't released an album yet, by the way. It's only an EP. So, wow. I would assume at some stage that'll be arenas. There's been a couple of shows where he supported Shawn Mendes on a couple of shows and they were arenas.
Yeah.
So, but to see the potential and see the fans like really connect with him on those big shows is just like I got so emotional. I was like, oh my God, crying. It's like, oh my God, this is amazing. But yeah, I love working with him. I love working, like the whole team's been working together for close to 10 years with Jeremy and Nate and Joel, who now does videography for Rule as well. Like we've all known each other forever.
It's like they're literally a dream team for Australia.
Yeah, well, it's like, and they're all my best friends as well, which is like, I'm literally going to Nate's house to have dinner tonight with Nate and Joel because I miss them so much. It's like the people that I spent the most time with last year on tour and stuff, I just never get sick of them. So very, very fortunate. But I love working with Rule and watching just every, like he, you know, him grow as a human being and as an artist. And he's just so stupidly talented. It actually makes me sick. So I just can't wait to see what's going to happen in the next couple of years. Should be really cool.
Awesome. And with such a team around him, I'm sure he's keeping his head kind of level, you know, like you're all pretty grounded human beings.
Yeah. I mean, he's the art. Totally. But his family's really great like that as well. Like they're really, really down to earth and awesome, awesome humans. And it really shows because he's just like such a good kid to deal with. And everybody that's involved loves every minute of it, you know, so it's the best. So I definitely want to be getting back on the road again and doing all of that stuff associated with him as well, so hopefully it's not too much longer.
Crazy.
Yeah,
I want to ask you one last question.
Cool.
where do you think Australia's heading politically with everything that's happened with Black Lives Matter and the recent protests in Australia and conversations around deaths in custody? It's hard, I think, because we're all so isolated, it's hard for us to all have like a full picture of what's going on. For some reason, being out in the public and going to a party or, I don't know, hanging with people physically for me makes me feel like I know more about what's going on in the world, you know, rather than when you're just online, you just get in your echo chamber, you know? So I just wanted to see what the vibe is from you at the moment.
It is really hard too, because it can be an echo chamber, you know, like you can be like, oh yeah, we're so progressive, especially in Melbourne too. We're so progressive. But it's like, however, I will say I've been to maybe 7 protests in the last 6 or 7 years. Either the Invasion Day protests or something similar around if someone had, you know, recently passed away or something, there's been quite a few protests. I've never, ever, ever seen anything like I saw these recent protests. It was like, it was actually really emotional. Like it was actually really very, very special, very overwhelming. So many people there. Like it's been so underreported. And I don't know the exact reasons for that. And I know that protesters have been demonized and we're all stupid and irresponsible and all those things because of COVID. But like, I know for myself and I know for my friendship group, how serious we took precautions, I guess, around that and how important it was for us to be there, even during a pandemic. Like there's probably nothing else that would have got me out at that time. Like that's how serious I took it. And I was weighing it up for a long time. I was, again, going back to all my epidemiology podcasts and going, okay, what is the actual risk? And speaking to doctors that I know that are in the industry as well, like I did take it really seriously and did think, okay, risk-wise, I actually think it's quite low. I think if we all wear masks and sanitize, and we try to distance as much as possible. And I firmly believe that is the case. I still think that is the case. The risk of being outdoors like that is quite low. But it felt like something had changed. It felt like there had been a shift in community views on this topic, just because of the sheer numbers and people talking about it that I'd never seen talking about it. People asking me stuff that I know I'd had either arguments or run-ins before, that genuinely wanted to learn this time. Mm. It felt different. Having said that, I've also got friends that, you know, especially in America, that are a little bit more wary, if that makes sense. Like, we've been here before and been disappointed, I guess. So, I mean, yeah, it's hard. It's hard to know because Australia is so different comparatively to America. And there still are so many people that I think that it's an American problem. But I do think it woke up a lot of people that were very ignorant to the issue. And there was a lot of really genuinely good conversation happening, as well as the frustrating. And I know that I saw your post on Facebook a few times that you know, chose not to engage that day or chose to engage. And I was very much the same. Like, you had to be in the right mood to engage. But I would say overwhelmingly, the engagement that I had was actually quite positive. And if I took, you know, if I saw someone post "All Lives Matter" and I knew that person was a genuinely good person, that they weren't a piece of shit and they weren't racist, and I took the time to say, "Hey, I know what you mean when you say this, but you need to know that that phrase has been co-opted by people that it to mean something different. And when you post that, it shows a lack of empathy, even though you're trying to do the opposite. It actually shows a lack of empathy for a very serious issue." And most people were quite receptive to that, to be honest.
Awesome.
And again, like, picking the people that I know have their heart in the right place.
Yeah.
And
people that have said it out of a mistake.
Out of a mistake.
Trying to be malicious.
Exactly. And there is obviously a difference because there's a lot of people out there that do use it maliciously. But for the people that I knew personally, and it's like, no, this person, they just don't know what they're saying. They don't understand that. And they're not as connected online, or they're not on Twitter, and they don't, of those things. Yeah.
That's the thing. That's the thing that I'm at the point at now. It's like, I think it's real dangerous that we assume everybody knows what's going on socials, because then we are not just marketing social media for social media companies. We are like enforcing social media on people. If we're saying, if you don't post about something, that means you're not supporting the right side.
Don't get me started. Oh my God.
If you don't know that All Lives Matter is offensive, then you should have
Googled
it.
Well, then you're a racist as well.
It's like, it's a fucking hashtag, man.
Yeah.
Like, really?
I have.
It's crazy, man. That's too far for me.
It's too far. There's actually an elitist view in terms of that everybody is as educated as you are at a particular moment in time, especially for people like us that have been doing work for a long time. I had this exact argument on Twitter the other day. It actually nearly made me quit Twitter, because there was people that I really admire and really look up to in a both journalistic sense and just being on Twitter and following, but they got a whole heap of people got stuck into Tim Minchin the other day. He was on a podcast with Will Anderson, and he was saying this very thing. He was saying, his words were, "I don't think shouting racist at people who post All Lives Matter is helping the problem. I don't think it's helping the problem or the cause." And he had suggested that he had seen friends of his who are white allies posting on social media and shouting at other people because they weren't posting on social media. And his whole argument was like, those people need to have conversations with the All Lives Matter people to help them explain what that issue is, why that is offensive, why that has been co-opted by other people, rather than just going, you've got no fucking idea, you're racist, you're stupid. Because what happens then? You're going to push them the other way. We don't need that. And yeah. I guess the argument was like, he had worded it weirdly.
Yeah.
And someone had thought that he had meant that, I guess, black people or Indigenous people should educate. And I don't believe that at all. I actually think it's allies that should educate. And I think Tim was saying that as well.
Yeah. I guess I would put that caveat in there as well, that it's not up to us to tell Aboriginal people or black people how they should be protesting, whether they should call someone a racist or not a racist.
No, he was specifically talking about white allies. Yeah. And I think people took it as, you know, either black people or brown people or Indigenous people. And I completely agree. Like, they can protest however they like. It's not up to them to be nice or anything like that. It's more, I think, on allies to have those conversations. And I think I used the example of myself having really successful conversations with those people.
Also, none of us are born woke. Like, nobody pops out the womb with the fucking dictionary, the Urban Dictionary and the hashtag dictionary and knowing the nuances of all of this shit. Like, we don't know. Like, all of us, a friend of mine said recently, we all ripen at different times. And I really like that, you know?
That's a great point.
We're, you know, everyone's learning different things at different times. So just because you learn something, I mean, I get frustrated and I find it difficult to have certain conversations when I hear really ignorant sentences. Mm. And I find it, you know, I find it difficult, but I think I'm getting better to know what my line is on where I engage and where I don't engage and how much I engage and who do I engage with and judging the situation and whether that's worth it and whether that's not worth it. Because there is nuance in that. I know social media wants us all to shout and argue with all of our racist aunties and parents.
It does. It
wants us to cancel all of our racist aunties and...
Well, not only that, just wants us to cancel each other as well.
Like, yeah, exactly. And wants us to, you know, defriend everybody.
Defriend, yeah. That's so...
But that does contribute. I understand that as a safety mechanism, if you're feeling triggered by people's things. Fine, you know, I understand. But I also understand that what that does is create a deepening of the echo chambers, an entrenching of the echo chambers, and that can't be good.
Also, how much the knowledge of what we know about particular issues has moved so much in, say, the last 10 years or 5 years around language, around all kinds of issues. And those of us that try and keep up with it have a hard enough time keeping it, let alone people of an older generation or that aren't on social media as much. All of these things that contribute to them not being as aware. And I definitely see that just the shouting and people going into their corners and becoming more and more and more separated is actually not helping the issue. So, yeah, and like I said, I'm definitely not saying that people should be nicer around their racism or anything like that. I just think it's on allies to speak to their racist auntie or their person that has popped up on Facebook or whatever, like ask to take on some of the labor in that regard. Yeah, that's what I was trying to get across before.
Yeah, taking on the labor and taking it on our shoulders, not shying away from it, but also understanding that there's nuance and there's ways of doing it. And there's, you know, if you know your auntie really well and you know that she's going to react negatively if you just shout at her and never talk to you again and entrench yourself in her racist ways and make it mean that you're even, that she was even more right than before, then maybe that's not the best way to go about it. But there could be a situation where that is the best way to go about it, where someone needs to be, you know, shocked just being like, no, that's some racist bullshit, you know.
The nuance thing is so important. And I think it's definitely, Twitter is impossible to have any nuance on. Facebook.
Well, that's why I agree with so much that goes on in Facebook. I agree with so much. I agree that if we don't say anything to retaliate or to talk back to people that are posting extremely racist views on socials, that does allow racism to fester and grow. So I don't think there should be no pushback. I really do understand that there should be pushback. However, that also feeds into the algorithms. Like that's what they want.
Like, they're going to show you more of that too.
How many likes your posts get. They care how many comments your posts get. So the more argumentative those comments are, those posts are, and the comments are in those posts, then the more value that post has. So in some ways, entrenching each other within our echo chambers and then having these divisive posts that make people from both sides argue, that is the most popular or most profitable post.
And showing them in more people's feeds and stuff like that.
Right. Because
also to really get rid of the idea of people are either good or bad, I think is really, really, really not a good idea.
Yeah.
And putting people on pedestals and, you know, if a celebrity makes one little wrong post or you found something that they did 13 years ago or like it just drives me insane that we're not allowing people growth and people that did do the dumbest shit like a decade ago. Like if we're not allowing growth, then like what is the point? Like
It's a difficult one, eh? It's a difficult one because you know there are definitely certain cases where especially men have done shitty things many years ago and it's shitty enough for it to mean something today. And and it usually involves the law and going to prison.
Yes. Yes. I mean, if you're talking about sexual assault or stuff like that, then that's like, for me is like, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking more about a dumb tweet or even language that we've now evolved to not use anymore. Yeah, and people will pull that as an example of that they're a piece of shit and they've not changed or like people evolve, especially in when you're talking about 10 years, like we've come so far with what is acceptable and what people joked about and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. I saw an interview with the guy that played Con the Fruiterer. You remember that Greek character?
I do. When he was in brown face as well.
Yeah. So I grew up on that basically, you know, I grew up on that and Acropolis Now. Acropolis Now and all that shit. And I understand that Acropolis Now, you know, because it makes fun of us, it kind of gives permission for white people to also make fun of us. And that can be a bit dangerous. But I didn't think of that at the time. I just thought it was fucking hilarious. Like I loved it, you know.
Well, because we'd never seen ourselves represented like that. That was the thing. So like
even though it was a bit of a minstrel show, it was a bit of a like, you know.
But at the time,
It was like, that's mad. My culture's on TV. Like that's
exactly. And the Wog Boys and all those guys as well. Like
yeah. So they did a poll in Neos Cosmos in the Greek Australian newspaper.
Yeah.
Asking people if they find Con the Fruiterer offensive or if they loved it. And like overwhelmingly Greeks loved it and still love it. I don't know if that's necessarily because the demographic of people that read Neos Cosmos are maybe a bit older and maybe don't, you know, aren't as politically savvy or whatever, but I can understand. Like I've had the question in my head for a while, like, yeah, what about Con the Fruiterer, dude? That's a white guy.
I mean, I also playing think
a Greek
too,
and playing a Greek woman and a Greek man, like Marika and Con.
The thing is like,
but he did it well.
He did. Yeah. And also too, this is the thing about looking at stuff retrospectively, like, yeah, that wouldn't fly now. But you can't look at things that happened in the 80s with the same lens. Like we have completely moved on from that. And we can look at it and go.
Look at it as an artifact.
Look at it as a historical moment in time that it's kind of amusing that they've got away with it. But like you said, like I do actually think that some of that stuff that we do look down and go, oh my God, like can't believe that happened. Especially for us WOGs, like there was definitely the visibility in the media and being able to be accepted, I think definitely happened during that period because it,
visible. I guess what happens is that in Australia, cute multiculturalism is okay. White Australia is comfortable with cute multiculturalism when it's, you know, nice and sweet and funny and the food tastes good and the music's good and, you know. But when it comes to like actual becoming stakeholders in this company called Australia,
that's when it's an issue.
That's when it becomes an issue. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
When ethnics decided that, you know, rainbow festivals of people from all different cultures wasn't enough, then it started becoming a bit of a problem, you know, that we want more than just being laughed at and having our food eaten and having a corner store and, you know, being done with it.
Yeah.
Then it became a bit too much. And I think that, you know, just as you say that you've never seen a protest like that, and I've never seen a protest. I went to the protest here and I've never seen a protest. There's never been a protest that big in this area before.
Yeah, it was really awesome.
And I cried like 5 or 6 times just listening to the speeches and listen to people, listen to a crowd of mainly white people cheer somebody talking about Indigenous sovereignty. You know, like it was healing.
Overwhelming. I completely agree.
It was powerful. It's not everything, but it was powerful. It's a shift.
It's a shift, yeah.
But I wonder, though, because this is what happened after Obama was in power for so long in the States. I wonder if then there's going to be a huge backlash.
Huge shift. Yeah, this is what my friend says.
We're going to have like a Pauline Hanson prime minister situation. You know, like
this is what my friend says. That's and he's African American and he's he doesn't live in America anymore. But he, when I talk to him about these issues, that's what he's afraid of. He's afraid of the swing. Yeah. So it's hard to know, really. I don't have the crystal ball and I don't really know. I just think that it's great that the conversations are happening. I definitely wish that there was a little bit more empathy and just love, and it sounds really airy fairy, but I just think we should just need to care for each other a little bit more, because I'm seeing some pretty horrifically nasty stuff. It's making me want to disengage from people that were not usually like that either. So it's just that polarizing stuff that I actually don't think is helpful, and then trying to meet in the middle and find middle ground, I think, is really, really important. And I think we've got so used to just locking it, you know, like deleting and you're cancelled and off you go, you're a piece of shit, and we go into our corners and nothing is getting solved. And it's, you know, mixing with those people and being friends with people that have completely different opinions. That's one of the things that I've done over the past few years, is actually listen to podcasts of people that I have really, really different opinions, and just sit there and just sit and listen to it and just go, is there anything in this, you know, that I agree with? And most of the time, even with people that I like vehemently disagree with, there'll be something in there that a moment or a sudden, I understand where he's coming from. I don't agree with him in any of this stuff, but I actually understand where that person's coming from or that woman's coming from with this, you know, like just sitting with stuff that really challenges me has been really beneficial for me over the last couple of years.
Yeah. And I think through that, the lines between left and right, or the viciousness between left and right, gets a bit softened. Because we kind of go, well, I do agree with that, and it's not a nasty opinion, and it's not a horrible opinion, and or I do agree with the fact that they believe that.
Yeah,
I don't believe those statistics that they're basing their belief on is right, but if I believe those statistics, I could see how they come to that conclusion.
They've come to that. Yes, this is exactly what I mean. Yeah,
and then the left and right starts to collapse, and then we have to base our decision on a moral backbone. Mm-hmm. On a moral and ethical backbone that goes beyond left or right, or you know, sexism or classism or racism or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, what is your moral backbone? Are you just following the trends? Are you just like, oh yeah, Black Lives Matter because now it's cool, but 10 years ago you didn't give a fuck, and 10 years from now you might not give a fuck? You know, like, what's it based on, really?
Yes, yeah.
I think there's a lot of people that used to be for equality, but now that it looks like equality might come, now they're kind of jumping ship and they're a bit worried that, you know, Black Lives Matter is cool in theory, but in practice, what, you know, like I think the underlying racist kind of comes out when they see that
come
it's,
out.
Could be
yeah,
possible.
There's a movement. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I just agree with everything that you said. I just think there's a possibility to be a middle ground, and we continue demonizing people and or dehumanizing people, and it's when nothing historically has come good from that has come historically, if that makes sense. So
yeah,
I start to get really nervous when I start seeing that from people that I believe are on the left and are not like that, and I start seeing that and I'm like, this is not a good place to be.
Yeah
it's really worrying. So
it's hard though, because I fully understand it. I understand why people say we need to actually be violently resisting Nazism. Mm-hmm. I understand why people say, you know, Donald Trump and people of his ilk cannot be even thought of as human. Like, I understand why people say that. But yep, there's something same. About it that never feels right.
Well, it's just because it's never ended well in the past.
Well, you know what does feel, the only thing that does feel right of that world is that I do believe in violent self-defense. Like, if someone's
totally
coming to
fuck
with me in a military sense, then I'm there for that.
Look, don't get me wrong. When the protests started happening in America, and there were, you know, quite isolated but very media represented instances of looting and rioting, I was all for it. I was like, this is, people need to be heard, and if they haven't been heard for this long, something needs to happen. You can't just ask nicely for things.
Yeah, I'm with you. The funny thing is that people are like, oh, they shouldn't be protesting like this, or Aboriginal people, just, you know, why do they have to be so angry? Like,
so aggressive.
All they have to do is ask properly, and, you know, it's
what's properly mean, though?
But as though people haven't been asking nicely.
Yeah. Yes.
For 200 years.
Forever. Yeah. I mean, when I'm talking about these conversations, I'm very, very rarely talking about, you know, instances of people calling out racism or anything like that. It's really that the ally conversations that I'm seeing that is the most disturbing to me, rather than the out and out calling blatant racism or anything like that, because that's just unacceptable. That's not where I'm saying
it's non-negotiable.
It's non-negotiable, and that's not what I'm talking about being civil or anything like that. It's really the other issues that seem to take up a lot of the airtime and a lot of the Twitter feed, and
you mean other issues as in kind of lateral violence within the left?
Yes.
The left, yeah.
The left, yeah, totally. Yeah, cancelling of each other.
Yeah.
Somebody hasn't used the wrong language today, or someone isn't feminist enough today, or someone isn't, I don't know, whatever.
The shittiest thing about that is that that's actually how Nazi Germany kind of came to power, because there were left, two sides to the left that couldn't agree, and then they couldn't come together and vote against Hitler, and that's how he got in. Not that I want to, you know, everyone uses Nazism as this overarching umbrella example, but that's usually how very far right wing groups get into power, because the left can't decide.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. So that's what feels
and
very.
And the right never seems to be that critical of each other. They're never don't. You didn't build enough mines this year. You didn't, you know, kill enough people. You didn't.
They don't seem to be each other. You didn't post enough white squares or whatever, like whatever they would have done. I don't know.
Exactly.
You didn't post.
Or you did post it, and that's wrong. But you didn't post it, and
that stuff just drives me. Like, honestly, I'm just like, oh, it's, come on. Let's unite. We're all on the same team here. We all want the greater good. Like, let's stop the fighting amongst each other. It's not. To be who's the most woke this week, like, I don't think it's beneficial at all.
Yeah, and I think it's possible without watering down the movement towards, you know, liberation and equality for all. I think it is possible to move forward with all these people doing all these different things in different ways, but all moving in the same direction without it needing to be like the hierarchy or the pulling down or the whatever. Sure, people are going to make mistakes. They're going to do it, you know, something that's not the best thing that yes. could have been done.
Yeah.
They're going to post something when they shouldn't have. They're going to say something in a way that they shouldn't have.
Yeah.
That, you know, like for this to really become a mainstream ideal and for it to become, you know, equality really for all, there has to be like a million horribly awkward, poorly worded conversations around yeah. kitchen tables every totally. Night of the week, all across yeah. the country.
Well, that
and
point
the whole
about,
thing will be a mistake.
Yes.
You know, in a sense, like the yes. whole thing will be completely.
That point about just allowing mistakes. In a direction. Yeah, I really feel like that's important. And it's like, you know, we're not going to get it perfect and it's okay. And like, just be a little bit kinder to each other if someone didn't use the right language in that particular moment and just, yeah. it's okay. That's what I'm kind of, yeah, talking to at the moment.
Yeah. And I'm loving all these voices that are rising up at the moment. I'm loving things that, you know, Neil Morris is posting and Jim Blah's posting and all yep. these, you know, like just all these powerful women as well that are coming forward and just.
I think that's been my favorite love. Part, actually. My favorite part has actually been just sitting back and not talking and totally. Just amplifying voices
just
and
reposting the fuck
sharing
out of everybody.
And yeah, just like. Especially with artists, like sharing
yeah.
really amazing artists that are creating great art. That's probably been my favorite thing. Yeah,
totally. Well, thank
Seems
you
like
so much.
It's got
my
dark
friend.
There.
Yeah, it's got dark here since we started talking. The sun went. The sun's gone.
Sun's gone down. That's so funny.
Legendary. Thank you so much for all the work that you do.
It's okay. That was a lovely chat. It's great. It's good
Thanks
to see
for
your
hanging.
Face.
Maybe I'll come and hang out on Twitch.
Come and hang out on Twitch. Sign up. And well, you don't even have to sign up. You can just come and hang.
Nice.
But if you sign up, then you can comment and then I'll know that you're there. So you won't be lurking as much.
Yeah, I don't want to be a lurker.
Yeah.
It's not good.
No.
All right. Much love.
Much love to you. Thank you so much. I'll talk to you really soon.
Yeah. Peace.
Bye.
Amber Lights. The boys at school and I disappeared between classes, passed tobacco between our hands like water at the well. Smoke signals provided translation between multicolored kids wagging in a vacant lot. We met there between family and school, felt most at home in the no man's land where the old and the new worlds couldn't find us. We ever met there for fights, first kisses, swigs of alcohol on weekend nights. It's even where my friend Mark told me about how our friend Omar had died. And I found the truth somewhere between his explanations. Us kids grew up in that vacant lot, between being Greek, Lebanese, Italian, Vietnamese, and Australian, knowing we were no longer truly either one, but somehow both. Migrant kids are like rivers, always moving, but somehow still enough to be given a name like Wog, Nip, Fake, hyphen, Australian. So of course, when we learned how to drive, we'd ride for hours in the only place where we felt like we belonged, somewhere between points A and B, between the green and the red. I learned to love the traffic lights when they turned amber because I realized our teachers also slowed down in their approach to us and tapped their feet impatiently for our answers. I learned to rest my head in the elbows of my lovers, somewhere between their hearts and their hands, like the moon. I keep my distance because it's the only thing that makes me look like I'm standing still enough to get close to. And I write my best work in transit, in hotel rooms where the linen is transparent and the paintings by no one. I write so the silences between my words can begin to make sense, and I exist somewhere between the surface of the page and the tip of the pen. So I wrote this piece like my life in the margins, but I made the whole thing, the title, a dawn and a dusk, somewhere between the ridges, the pinnacle and the cusp. So when they tell me I'm not political enough, not Greek enough, not Australian enough, not a poet enough, not street enough, not me enough, I tell them I'm a star and I exist somewhere between you seeing me shine and realizing I'm already dead to you. I just let you witness some of my burning. I'm not a hyphen. I'm a 100-meter dash between my histories and your make-believe, between white Australia policies and being saved by the colony, between having to drag my past kicking back into my present and then hide it behind my back in your presence. So be careful when you place that hyphen in my name, or I'll use it to cut your throat, just to show you how much I love this country, but that I will always have some Sparta in me. I may be an amber light, but amber is the only gemstone that is a living, flowing liquid, permanently fossilized, that keeps itself warm, that is used as medicine, that smells sweet when it gets burnt, that in Roman times was worth more than a slave, that was named electron by the ancient Greeks, a precursor to the English word for electricity, because they discovered that if rubbed the wrong way, amber will always create a spark, and amber has only ever increased in value when some of us insects are discovered stuck in it. So of course, us in-betweens, the most rare, would gather around the fires in that vacant lot, share fleeting moments of belonging, and tell stories in our silences of how our friend Omar was sent flying between the hood of a Holden and the wall of a house like a shooting star. I'm just glad I got to witness some of his burning.